As many of you know, we are in the process of integrating two families in our home into one family. We adopted four kids a few months ago. And so really, in many ways, what we've come to realize over this journey is that when you're taking a story like this, we have four biological children, four adopted children, and the two of us, and you are bringing that together, that is like the collision of tectonic plates on the planet. You know, I mean, it just does not simply go... And because the truth is, there are so many variables and so many dynamics and so many realities and so many things that all have to find their way in that you can't possibly hope to control this collision. It has to just sort of happen, and everything has to make its way together, and then finally you have a new continent and you're okay. And that's sort of where we're at. And as much as Brooke and I, as adults, are weeding our way through this and dealing with this and processing this and sometimes just not processing anything and just going, as much as that is happening, I can't even begin to imagine for these eight children, all of them 14 and under, what it must be like to process this level of change in their life at this young of an age. I mean, in some ways, a child's life is supposed to be a predictable, stable process through a wonderful life, right? I mean, at its best, that's what it should be, and this is the opposite of that. And so I recognize and I've seen in tangible ways the different moments where any one of my eight children, the process of all of those emotions and all of those fears and all of those realities kind of come out in different ways. And each of my children have different ways in which they process this kind of stuff. And you get to see it. Some of them, you know, deceive and divert. And some of them, sink into quietness and whine and complain. And some of them lash out in anger. And some of them throw temper tantrums and stomp around. I mean, it's all different. And you kind of get to see it all. And when you have this many children, it seems like all of the possibilities are available to you to observe, because they're all doing different things. And Friday night, we got to live through the reality of one of these particular processes. It was bedtime around 8:30, 8:45, and in order to get eight kids down at an appropriate hour so they can get rest, I have to have certain structures in place. And so one of the things we have is, you know, once in bed and once down, if you happen to get up again for all the silly reasons that kids find to get up, that's cool, but we add 10 minutes to the bedtime the next night, and it kind of moves backwards. So it's not a big consequence. It just means tomorrow night you start at an earlier point than everybody else because you need to apparently get up several times. And so we have that working. We just kind of started that idea. And so Friday night, the boys are all sleeping in the playroom together. They do that on Friday nights sometimes because they can get to watch a movie together and then go to sleep. And one of the boys gets up because he's hot and starts fiddling with lights. And another boy comes down and says, "Someone's fiddling with lights." And so I go up and I do what I do. You know, I go, "Okay, I'm going to cool it down a little bit, but, you know, tomorrow night, 10 minutes extra." And this time it was my 10-year-old son, and that didn't bode well with him, the 10 minutes extra the next night, because this was a valid reason to get up. He was genuinely hot and needed to turn this, and so that seemed like an injustice. And that started just a slight move toward that person that sort of goes, "Whoa, everybody step back. This is wrong. I'm not happy with this." And that kind of pokes to the pride areas in our lives. And so as I was sort of settling him back down, I could tell he was just irritated. And so I said, "You know, if you're too hot here, if you'd like to sleep in your own room, that's fine with me." It was genuinely like a, "You know, you can sleep there or here because there's a fan in there and you can do that. I mean, we have AC, but, you know, we don't turn it way down." And so I don't think he wanted to sleep in his own room, but at this point, there's now pride involved and things involved, and so he says, "Fine, yeah, I'll do that," which was an interesting move, because now I'm moving the mattress to that room, and he's by himself in that room, and he's 10, and he doesn't like being by himself, and he doesn't love being in a room in the dark by himself especially. And so now I go downstairs, and at midnight, about midnight, Brooke and I come up to go to bed, and I walk past the room, and he's sitting on his mattress like this. He's sitting like this with the covers wrapped on him, just staring out of the door. And I go, "Buddy, you got to go to sleep. It's midnight, and you're up. And he just shakes his head, which is what he does when he's starting to fall into this mode, right? The night progressed from there, and it didn't go well. We moved into moving from anger to defiance. The defiance moved into specific and direct defiance, which then moved into me eventually going into the room, laying next to him and holding him like this so he could fall asleep, which that has worked in the past when these things have happened. It didn't work this time, and that affected greater defiance and greater pushing, eventually lots of kicking and wrestling and hitting from the small to the big, just so you know. And I'm just holding, and adrenaline starting to rise, and then it turned into the screaming started happening. We're upstairs. I have 7 other children sleeping. It's 1 in the morning at this point, and waking 7 children up at 1 in the morning is never a good idea, just so you know. And so I pick him up, and I carry him down the stairs, which wasn't probably the best move in the world, because we several times almost didn't make it down the stairs because he was very, very angry and kicking and screaming and hitting. And so I'm carrying him, and there's blankets involved, and it's dark, and I'm like, step, step, and I go down the stairs because I want to get down to the room downstairs so we can settle this down. And I remember having the distinct thought on the stairs when we use the word in English, you are blinded by rage. This would probably be that moment, right? Where it's no longer my 10-year-old son who I'm holding. It is a blinded reality of rage and adrenaline that has now been fully consumed, and I have to break this. And I just remember thinking, I want to dive into his heart and I want to go and rescue him from this. Because whatever this is that has grabbed a hold of him, it is now tearing at him and pulling him down into a dark and deep place. And I have got to go in there with him, and I've got to get him, and I've got to bring him back. And whatever that's going to take, I got to do. So we go downstairs and we get into the room downstairs, and the defiance increases, and there's rushing at the door, and there's turning lights on, and I'm removing light bulbs. At one point, I literally had a foot on a door and a hand on a boy and a light bulb and a hand on a foot and a foot on a hand. I don't even remember. I just remember going, this is insane. This was at 2 in the morning. And then in the middle of all of that, I just remember I was sitting at the door with my pillow propped against the wall, leaning against the door so he couldn't get out of the door because there just needed to be calm. And I just started praying, because I just got such a clarity on the magnitude and the power that sin has to tear and to crush and to break everything we have. I mean, I was watching it in front of my very eyes, and I didn't even know what to do to try to change this moment. I just knew that if we were in one room together, that at least we had a shot at making it through. And eventually, after trying numerous talks and things and stuff, and I could tell that it was just settled deeply within, I said, look, let's just go upstairs and let's just try to sleep, and we'll talk about this in the morning. And I knew in that moment that there was going to be a win on the part of rage. Have you ever had that feeling where you just go, I can't believe darkness is winning this round? And I knew I just had to give in because there was no more fight that we could go down that wouldn't result in an entire night being up. So we went upstairs, and I made a little bed next to my bed, and he finally fell asleep. The next morning, we woke up, and I made waffles for breakfast on Saturdays. We tend to do that. And after breakfast, I called my son into the room, and we sat down, Brooke and I, and my 10-year-old and my 14-year-old, so the translation could happen if necessary. And we were talking about the reality of lessons that we learn when the darkness wins, you know? And that night, he learned, if he pushes hard enough, if he's angry enough, I will give in, because it's 3 in the morning, and what choice do I have? And that's a dangerous lesson to learn. That's a very dangerous lesson to learn. So in order to compensate for that lesson, we need to make sure that there is a price and a process to demonstrate that you didn't get off free last night. You didn't win, you actually lost. And so we started talking about what that would be. And my son loves soccer, and he particularly loves Manchester United. That's his favorite team. And I just ordered one of the computer networks. Today, there is a game between Manchester United and some other team. I don't know which one. And he was so excited because they've been anticipating this for weeks now. And I said to him, look, all media is gone for the week, iPads and iPhones and all that stuff. And immediately the words came out, soccer. Can I watch soccer? And I said, no, that's part of the media world. And all of the weight of that sin that was there last night that had the ability to crush rose up in a single instance, and all of the defiance came back. And he literally, you could just, it was like watching the rising of darkness. And I knew in that moment, this is all wrong. This is all wrong. How did we get here? And from there, it went downhill fast. And it entered into rooms. And then at one point, I had to carry him into his room and put him in the room. He was so wild, and I pulled the door shut, and then it began. I started hearing the banging on the door, and the banging stopped for a moment, and then the banging changed, and you realized it was no longer fists, it was now weapons, right? And suddenly when the wood started cracking, my wife said, I think he's going to break the door, and my answer was, the door is a cheap price to pay for this lesson. And just kept banging, and eventually it was, I literally knew it was going to come through the door. And so my wife said, that's enough, and we opened the door, and then I went in and I held him, and for 10 minutes I just held him, and you just felt it all just in there, you know? There were several moments in that journey that I took. In a matter of hours, from 8 p.m. to about noon, that process with my son. There were several moments where I was so overwhelmed by the direction in which we were moving, the direction downward, watching darkness rise around me, that I didn't even know what to do. And I remember just crying out in my mind on numerous occasions, God, just redeem this. Just rescue us now from this. Just come. Just change this. Just bring this. And in those short moments, there were moments where I was like, where does this go? Where does this end? At what point does this change? And it got me thinking the next morning after we worked through everything, and the afternoon was phenomenal with my son, and we had incredible conversations and incredible learning moments, and things are incredibly good now again with that. And so in my part, I got to see redemption take place immediately, but it got me thinking, what about those circumstances that we find ourselves in where you get the distinct feeling inside that this is all wrong? Have you ever felt that? Where you look around and you go, this is not the way it should be. This is not the way it was meant to be. This is not the way it should happen. I mean, they are big things, right? When disease riddles our body and it is tearing us apart, and you just know that you serve a God that is big and powerful and awesome, and this isn't the way it should be. Have you ever felt that? Or when a child dies, an incident happens, an accidental, and a car accident or something, and you just deep down, you go, this isn't the way it should be. This isn't what it should look like. Have you ever felt that? Have you ever been in a set of circumstances where your life is falling apart and it just feels like you've been longing and waiting for God to redeem it, and you start playing this game? You're in the middle of the darkness and it seems to be doing this and it seems to be winning, and you look ahead and you go, oh, okay, I get it now. He's going to do this right here. He's going to rescue me right here. And then you get to the right here and you pass right on by it and he doesn't show up. And then you stretch a little further ahead and you go, oh, he's just allowing this so that the beauty of that can emerge. And then you get there and you pass right on by it and he doesn't show up. And how many times does that happen before you go, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's not coming. Maybe this is all never going to work. Have you ever stood there? Because I have. And I am grateful that I am not the only one that have stood there. But if I go back into time, I realize that the followers of Jesus that had the privilege of having him with them on the planet, walking with him, talking with him, experiencing him, they have lived this reality in a context larger than we can ever begin to imagine. They have stood in hopelessness. They have stared into darkness and they have wondered what on earth is going on. And they have been there. And that is exactly the story that we get to walk into today. I am not going to be spending a lot of time in the scriptures verse by verse because this story expands over four gospels and over several chapters in each gospel. So just trust me that I've read this. And if you want to go and read all of the details, it is in John 18 and 19, Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 23, and all of the chapters expanding around that. But let us travel through the story as it progresses with the disciples from their vantage point, and let us watch the darkness rise and understand what they are experiencing. The story begins with a triumphal entry, at least our little story. Jesus has collected a large amount of followers. They have traveled from the northern region of Israel down to Jerusalem, and they are now entering into Jerusalem. And the triumphal entry, as you remember, is the moment where the people declare that the Messiah has come, the promised one who will rescue them and set them free, and finally, once and for all, establish Israel as a nation that will rule over the earth and will never again, ever, ever be under the oppression of other empires. That was the great hope they had. They had a circumstance. Rome had once again completely consumed them. Rome was not the first. They'd been through Babylon and Persia and Greece and so many, you lose count at a certain point. And now this was the end of that story. And it was very clear Jesus had declared it, that he was the promised one. And as he entered into Jerusalem, he enters in triumphant as the king. And the Passover meal, this is during the time of Passover, it seemed, if you went back into history, that it seemed the promise would be tied to Passover and revealed through Passover. So you've got to put two and two together. Triumphal entry, Jesus declared promised one, and the Last Supper. Well, it wasn't going to be the Last Supper at that point, but the Passover meal. And so at the Passover meal, Jesus is teaching the disciples extraordinary truths about the new kingdom and what it's going to look like. And so you put two and two together. Jesus is talking new kingdom here. I mean, he did mention death at several points through the process, but that's just part of the extraordinary, crazy plan he has. What we need to focus on is new kingdom. New kingdom is coming. And you even have the disciples arguing at that very meal. Who's going to sit at your right hand? Who's going to sit at your left hand? Who's going to be down on the bottom? And they want to know how it's going to roll because they are excited. If there's ever been a moment in all of history where hope was at its highest, this was that moment for these people. You couldn't have had a greater hope. And the anticipation literally was, could it be possible? Could it be possible that this very day, after this very meal, we will begin to see the progress of Jesus' victory over the world and beginning to expand his power and territory? Because we've seen his power. Late that Thursday night, they leave the meal and they head down to a garden. And in the garden, there is some prayer time that takes place. And that prayer time has an odd tone to it. It's as though the tone changes from this incredible hopefulness and this incredible anticipation to something not being quite right. This is like a little moment. Have you ever gotten that feeling like you're at the beginning of a downward spiral and you kind of know it, but you just don't know it yet? And you're like, oh, I don't think this is going to go well. Have you ever been there? In the garden, during the prayer time, you get this sense that something isn't quite the way it should be. But it's not enough yet to put your finger on. And then it begins to unravel. The soldiers show up with Judas being one of the 12, betrayed by a friend. Doesn't that feel all wrong to you? It is all wrong. It's amazing how the picture that's painted for us through this story of Jesus, it's almost as though every moment goes wrong. It's like the extreme version of every moment going wrong. One of your 12 followers betrays you. The Roman soldiers take you. And can you imagine Peter pulling the sword ready to fight? And I guarantee you he was thinking, you have no idea what the guy behind me can do. I mean, you know it, right? He's seen it. Jesus has literally gone quiet to the wind and the seas and they stopped. He has said to the dead, rise, and it is risen. I mean, this is no joke, right? I mean, he could wipe people off with the fling of his hand. Whoa, and they can all just fly back and die. You know it. And so Peter goes, this is the beginning of the end for you. Except for the fact that Jesus puts his sword back and Jesus says, take me. And then Peter follows and John follows and they get to the Jewish trial. And I wonder what might have been going through the disciples' minds. I wonder if they did what we do, where they thought to themselves, I wonder at what point it's all, I just want to be there when Jesus finally goes, it's me, and reveals himself as the King of Glory. I mean, when does it happen? At the Jewish trial? That makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, oh, I get it now. The reason Jesus allowed them to take him in the garden is so he could reveal himself in front of the Jewish leadership. That makes so much sense. Except that that didn't play out well, did it? He was convicted of blasphemy and murder by these people and carted off to the Roman court system to go and talk to Pilate. And then it all makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, don't you stand there? I know I play these games and you go, I get it now. It's Rome he has to overthrow, not the Jewish people. So he's allowing the sequence of events to take place, these horrible downward spirals where it seems like death is winning, but death will not win because, don't worry, he's got a plan. And then he goes in front of the Roman, and even when Pilate is saying things like, you know, what is truth? And I have the power to put you to death. And Jesus is saying things like, sorry, Pilate, you have no power. And you, if you even had the opportunity to listen into those words, you might go, here it comes, here it comes. It's going to be so good. And then it goes horribly wrong. Pilate sends him to Herod. He comes back to Pilate and he is convicted. Between the conviction, he's probably beaten to try to get, just beaten, you know, the kind of whip beaten that's not horrible and terrible, just kind of bad, don't do that again. And then he comes back, but this time he's convicted. But here's how he's convicted. You ready for this? Watch how wrong this goes. If you've ever wanted to see the full implications of how wrong sin makes the world, watch this. Pilate, being a secular-minded man with wisdom in him in the diplomatic arena, he says this to the people. I'll tell you what, I don't want to convict this guy because there's no reason to. He's no threat to the Roman Empire. But there is one that is deeply threatening to the Roman Empire and deeply threatening to his own people. He is a murderer. He is a killer. He is a terrorist. He is just a plain, mean man. And we want him off the streets. Here is Barabbas. Here is Jesus. I will release only one of them. You don't get to pick anyone. You either pick the worst of the worst or you pick this guy. Terrorist killer, philosophical poet. Your call. And you know, even if at this point you go, I wonder why Jesus hasn't affected power yet. Maybe he doesn't have the power we thought. At least he's going to navigate the circumstances to get himself released so he can regroup and come back later. Except that the people don't pick Jesus. They pick Barabbas. And in that moment, you have to sit, if you're the disciples, and you have to go, what on earth is happening here? What is going wrong here? That's the moment where I've gotten down the stairs and I'm in the room and I'm holding the door shut with a light bulb and I'm going, I just don't get it. What is happening here? I want to go back in time. I want to go back to the first moment where it was 10 minutes of bedtime the next night. That was easy. I want to take that back. I'm sorry I said that. Have you ever felt that? And maybe it was in this moment that he's standing there and he's going, okay, what now? But then they choose Barabbas. And Pilate throws his arms up and says, fine, you're convicted of death, go and scourge the guy and crucify him. And then they take Jesus and they scourge him. This is what the Roman Empire did to a convicted felon that was going to get the death sentence as a part of making it as bad as it can be. Before they crucify you, they scourge you with the most terrible process of tearing flesh from bone. They do that to Jesus, and to make things better, when you just think it couldn't get much worse, and you're hoping against hope that there's something you've missed in the equation, and you know now, although you've hoped for redemption along the way, it hasn't come, maybe now something will happen that will be so crazy cool, it's going to be unbelievable. And as you watch that happen, the soldiers actually start making fun of him because he is convicted of, guess what, being the King of the Jews. That's the best they've got. I convict you to death for being the King of the Jews. Go. So they make a crown of thorns for him, and they place it onto his head. And when you place crowns of thorns on heads, it creates a mess. And so you can imagine the sight of Jesus during this time. The sight of this man fully consumed by the reality of darkness. And you go, this is not going well. And then they take a cross, and they put a cross on his back, and he is dragged through the streets, and he is hung on the cross. And I read the story trying to find the moment where perhaps my last hope would exist. My last little moment of saying, as horrid as this was, I get it now. Jesus did all of this and endured all of this so he could do this right here. That moment for me personally occurred when a bunch of soldiers stood under the cross and shouted these words, "If you are indeed the God of the universe, the King of the Jews, then come off the cross and show us your power." If you were there, wouldn't you get that momentary hope? Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you be standing back as one of the followers? Not even one of the 12 disciples. Just one of all of those people that had followed Jesus with all of their hopes placed in his basket, with all of the fact that their future was his to give to them. And they stood watching him bleeding and dying on a cross, and they couldn't believe what they were seeing. And then they heard the words from a soldier, "If you're powerful, get off the cross." And I think if I were there, I might have gone, "You're kidding me. This is why he did all of this. This is why it happened. So that in front of the Jewish people and the Roman people and the Greek people and any other people, he could come floating off the cross and go, 'Now you will see.'" I would have felt that in deeply inside, and I would have gone, "It's worth it." The beating and the horror and the hopelessness I felt and watching my future torn to shreds by the power of sin, this is worth it. Jesus didn't come off the cross. Jesus didn't come off the cross. In fact, it was after that he started speaking words like these, "Why have you forsaken me?" What would that word bring to your mind? Would that bring great hope to you? Would that make you think the leader of the entire universe, the creator and sustainer of all things, is shouting, "I'm forsaken"? Wouldn't you start going, "Whoa, that's a bad sentence"? I would. And I would think to myself, is it possible? Is it possible that the weight of making all of this happen became too big for him? That he thought he could, he knew he could, we all knew he could, but maybe it was too much. And then he speaks the words, "It is finished." And if you don't know what those words mean, if you haven't lived past that moment and been able to look back, what do those words mean to you? Do those words sound like hopeful words to you? "It is finished. Take my soul." And all of the hope of the known world of God's people is lost on a cross, dies before their very eyes. They take a spear and they stab it into his side, and his heart explodes inside to make sure he's dead, and he is declared absolutely, completely, and totally dead. They remove him from the cross and they bury him in a grave. Have you ever stood there? Have you ever stood and looked at your life around you and gone, "What on earth went wrong here?" On the other side of a divorce, and it wasn't your plan? What? I got a glimpse of it in a few hours, the power and might and the crushing weight of sin. But expand that over days, weeks, months, years. At what point do you lose all hope? The disciples felt that day as their hope died. And the weight of sin seemed to have won the day. It had crushed the Savior, broken the promise, and left us in darkness. That's where they stood, folks. Sometimes we're so captivated by the resurrection that we forget the crushing weight of sin. This wasn't about a death on a cross. It was about the weight of sin. And for me, as I stood staring up at the cross with a dead Jesus on it, as they took his body down and watched them move his body to a grave and felt the hope drain from all of my body, just going, "This went all wrong and so fast." It was hours, Thursday night to Friday afternoon. There it is, hours from the highest of heights to the lowest of lows. I thought to myself, if I could go back, where would the moment be that started it all? That if I could go back and I could change that moment, take it back, if I could have been the one that sent, not now, we're not ready, where would that moment have been? And I think as I read the story, I would have concluded that the moment would have been in a garden just hours ago where Jesus was on his knees and I tasted in that moment that something was going wrong. And I felt like I needed to say, maybe we should leave here. This doesn't feel right. Something feels wrong. And I should have said something. I could have said something. And if I had said something, maybe I would have changed all of this. It would have been the moment in the garden, the moment of Jesus praying. And here's why. Because in that moment, you see the rising darkness. I think back to the moments with my son on Friday night. And I did that. I went back in my mind and I tried to figure out at which moment I could have done something differently. If I'd only done this instead of that, or only this instead of that, then it wouldn't have gone here. And when it went here, if only I did this instead of that, it wouldn't have gone here. And if only, have you ever played that game? And then but you can't, because right now you're holding a dead mess. And you can't go back. Why do I take us back to the garden? Because it is in the garden that the beginning of darkness began, at least from our vantage point. It was in the garden where Jesus felt the full weight of the burden that he was about to bear for us. And as much as I'd love to read you the story and hope that that will capture it, it is only captured most extraordinarily for me in a scene out of a movie that bears for us the full weight of what we got to see there. Stare at the scene through the eyes of the disciples. Stare at the scene standing under the shadow of the cross with dead Jesus coming off and thinking back, if only I had noticed what was going on there, I could have stopped this. Think of the scene that way and watch it with those eyes and see what it does. Take a look.
Edna.
Sina othia pui. Kuma. Piesrati. Shapreni me reshetar she. Tomonu alai.
Kahil mahir momba likul hatta
prakasay nafshi adnai prakasiti ptakti
laithai anashtigai lakaima Yakir Sagi Yaka Pidion Nasha Laithai Anashke La Laithai
Papa Kulit Kehu Henkehel Castigate me. A gain luck is far. Lay away the luck is far.
the full weight of sin and the full wrath of justice required an extraordinary act of grace and power. An act of such grace and such power that it is appropriate to use the word impossible in that sentence. It is impossible for anyone to carry the full weight of sin and bear the full wrath of justice. No one can do that. And yet, one did. But today, though we know what happens, we must first consider the weight that he took on. We must consider its crushing power, because when the darkness rises around us, we must remember that the darkness rising around us is a consequence of our divinity. It is a consequence of our choice as humanity to rule our own hearts. It is the reality in which we should not be surprised we live when we live there, because our destiny is death and darkness outside of the redemptive rescue of one who could possibly carry this burden. And we must stand in the darkness and go, this is heavy. This is crushing. This is destructive. This kills us. It is no wonder to me that the author of Hebrews, when speaking of the burden we carry to travel through this planet as human beings with the weight of sin still doing its work around us and sometimes in our flesh, that we must have something to look to say, I will consider this and know this so that I can bear under this weight. In Hebrews chapter 12, in verse 1, it says this, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. He starts by painting the big picture, and then he says these words, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint hearted. And then he goes on to say, our struggle against sin has not yet resulted in the sweating of blood. When Jesus lay in the garden, he sweat blood. And what is the author of Hebrews saying? When the darkness consumes you and you feel like all is lost and hope is gone, remind yourself, as I did on Friday night and Saturday morning on numerous occasions, as I held my son and anger had taken him and I was fighting with him, waiting, I reminded myself, consider him who has endured the full weight of sin so that you can rise up under the small burden of this story in this moment, because he has carried all of this and more. If Jesus could possibly redeem the full story we have walked through today, if he could possibly come back from the horror of dying on the cross, being forsaken and finding everything finished, if he could return from that, then that would be redemption beyond anyone's possible imagination, would it not be? Would that not take coming off the cross in power and make that look like a joke? Would that not look like standing up against Pilate or defeating the soldiers in the garden look like a joke? Yes, it would. But who comes back from the dead? Who rises when they were completely crushed? Who stands when they were totally broken? We must stand here today, staring at an empty cross and a body in a grave, to fully grasp the weight of the crushing power of sin before we get to step into the wonder of full redemption, so that when we are finished with this story in weeks to come, we can stand and say, if he could redeem this story that we heard today, then he can redeem any story. And he will. He may not redeem our circumstance, but he will redeem our story through any circumstance. We're going to have the worship team come up in a second. After I pray, they are going to just play the music of a song called Holy. The words will, if you know the song, rise up inside of you. Let them rise up. Let them linger there. But what I want you to do is just sit. They're not going to sing the words. They're just going to play the music. There's going to be a picture on the screen with an idea. Meditate on that idea. Hold on to it. And then grieve sin. Mourn it. Consider its weight. And stand in awe of the one who chose at all cost to walk in and bear it for us. Let's pray. God, as we stand here and we stare at the empty cross, still blood-stained as your body has been carried away, as we wonder if all hope is lost, as we consider that perhaps in this one moment, perhaps this time, it was indeed too much, perhaps the enemy was right in the garden, that this burden was too big for anyone to carry, that the cost too high to redeem the human race, that maybe this was the inevitable end of the power of sin and the inevitable consequence of our choice to pursue our own divinity, to rule our own hearts. As we linger here this week, and as we feel the full weight and grief and horror of what sin has done, whisper to us that if we can consider the weight you have carried, grasp it fully, it will lead us to repentance. It will lead us to redemption. And it will strengthen us to stand under the stories we are called to bear, and the weight of the sin we are called to carry, the cross we are called to hold, because we will walk in the shadow of your power and the redemption of your great work. Help us grieve sin. Help us see it in its full power and its full weight. And help us to stand in awe of the one who carried it for us. We love you, Jesus. Amen. Thank you. writes and says that it has been granted us not only to believe in Jesus, but also to suffer for his sake. We are told in Scripture that we have the privilege of bearing one another's sin. I get to carry the sin of my friends and my spouse and my children, and I get to bear it on their behalf, to walk in it with them as it impacts and affects and shapes and tries to crush me. And I get to do that not only because I get to suffer for Christ, but because I get to stand under it in the power of redemption that has been effected in me. I get to experience what it is like to be able to be a minister of reconciliation under the weight of the small sin that I get to carry in my story. And so also, as Christ walked out of darkness into light, I get to see not only the sin that is born through the actions of my friends and family around me and myself, but I also get to see the incredible power of redemption born in them as time progresses forward. To watch my son yesterday afternoon discover all of this and see with clear eyes what sin has done in him, and to walk from it in repentance and to seek light, was 1,000 times more dramatic and wondrous and powerful than the worst of the moments the night before. May we walk in this world bearing our burdens, and as Jesus did in the garden, say these words: if this could pass by me, I pray it will, but your will be done in this life. Then we will live free.